The Infrastructure Show is brought to you by Wyss Janney Elsner Associates. Engineers, architects, and materials scientists. Solving complex problems in contemporary and historic structures since 1956. Learn more at WJE.com.
Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
The San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge consists of two separate spans, each of about 10,000 feet in length. The west span connects San Francisco to Yerba Buena Island in the middle of the bay, and the east span connects the island to Oakland. Daily traffic is about 280,000 vehicles. Completed in 1936, the west span is a suspension bridge, and the original east span was a cantilever design. In 1989, during the Loma Prieta earthquake, a portion of the east span collapsed, with one fatality. While the damage was repaired quickly, the decision was made to construct an earthquake-resistant new east span of suspension design.
Construction of this new span began in 2002, parallel to the original cantilever span that remained in operation during the next 11 years. Finally, on September 3, 2013, the new east span was open for traffic. Here to talk with us today about the many challenges of completing this new bridge is Tony Anziano, who is Toll Bridge Program Manager for the California Department of Transportation, commonly known as Caltrans, the department that has managed this project in conjunction with the Bay Area Toll Authority and the California Transportation Commission. Tony, thanks so much for talking with us today.
I appreciate the invitation.
First, why don't you give us a little bit better description than we provided of this bridge in total, its location and the key components of it.
Sure. I think you gave a very good overview. There actually is one-third component of the structure that was built back in the 1930s. There is an approach section over on the west side of the bridge in San Francisco, about a mile long. We've gone through the process of replacing that entirely, which was a pretty challenging effort in and of itself because that's actually bounded on either side by residential and commercial properties. But other than that, I think you've given a very good overview. I think it is certainly fair to say that this bridge reflects the economic backbone, transportation backbone of the region. The traffic volumes, as you said, are extraordinarily high, about 280,000 vehicles per day. That usually puts it in the running for one of the top three bridges in the country in terms of traffic volumes. The other two that we're always competing with are the George Washington and the Woodrow Wilson, but it just shows you how important of a structure this is to the region.
So given the importance of the structure, when it's closed, as it was for a while after Loma Prieta and during the weekend phase over to the new east link, what do drivers do?
They find alternate routes or they stay home. And it's been a really interesting exercise that we've gone through. When we first started working on the project, the original assumption was you can't close the bridge. There's just too much traffic on it. There were some economic analyses that were done after Loma Prieta talking about economic effect of having the bridge closed, and there just was a sense you cannot close it. However, and this was actually an offshoot of working on that west approach structure I was talking about, because we were working within a community, we had a lot of conversations going on with the community, and when we got to the point where we were doing some significant demolition work that was going to be taking somewhere in the range of 8 to 9 weeks, we had a conversation with the community and asked them basically, would you rather have us try and compress this so that you're looking at, longer single duration periods of demolition work but a shorter overall duration, or would you rather just have us go with this 8-9 week duration? The community overwhelmingly said, get it over with as quickly as you can. And once we got that feedback, we started thinking a little bit more, well, what's the fastest way we could do it? Well, the fastest way would be to close the structure. And we also, at that time, were having a lot of traffic congestion when we were trying to do work simply under lane closures. Traffic was backing up, everybody thinking they'd be the last one to get to the point of the closure before the lane closure was implemented. So we basically decided, let's try closing the structure, and let's try and do it with a tremendous amount of outreach to get the community involved in the process. And we were able to convince folks that this makes sense. It really was a political call at the end of the day because of the importance of the structure, but we did get support on that. And what we found was that the community would work with us. If you give them good information, good alternate transportation, supplement transit, things like that, it works. Yes, there's congestion. You can't get away from that. But everybody was very accepting of it. Once we knew we could close that structure successfully, it opened the door to a lot of work, especially over on the East Span, that we otherwise would not have been able to do. And in particular, some of the work that we did over on the western portion of the East Span. There was a little piece right up next to the tunnel where you do have overlap between the existing and the new alignment, where we would have had to retrofit about a 300-foot-long section of bridge as opposed to replacing it entirely if we were not able to close the bridge. Being able to close the bridge allowed us to get that 300-foot span replaced entirely. So now we've got a new bridge end-to-end over on the East Span.
So what was the longest period that the bridge was closed, setting aside the earthquake?
It was a little bit over 4 days. We called it a 4-day closure, but we started early on. Well, actually, I'll take it back. Our last one was a 5-day closure, so I'm thinking a little bit too far back in the past here. But our last closure to get the bridge open was 5 days, and a little bit over that because we start late in the night, the day before we're actively doing the work, and then we try and get it open for the morning commute in the last day. But it's slightly over 5 days.
So that 5-day closure was the phase over to the new bridge?
Yes.
So how was it that you made the decision to build a new East Span rather than retrofitting the old span to be more earthquake resistant?
It really was a function of the decision to have a lifeline structure in place there. One of the things we started doing when we really modified our retrofit program on a statewide basis, we started looking at, where do we have structures that are of unusual importance in terms of route continuity, in terms of emergency response, and where we had structures where clearly there was no detour and clearly they were tremendously important to emergency response, we designated them as lifeline. And that meant that they had to perform better than our conventional standard, our conventional seismic criteria, which is no collapse. That's our fundamental life safety standard. But in certain cases, you have to do better than that. Not only do they not have to come down, but you have to be able to use them very quickly after a major seismic event. And that differential for a long span structure like the East Span in terms of cost is big. And in terms of reliability, you've got to have the best assurance that you can that you will be able to achieve those performance standards. And in the case of the situation that we had terrible underlying geology. We had an older structure that is fairly complex in and of itself. We simply did not believe that it could be retrofit to achieve that performance level. And a decision was made to go with a new structure at that location.
So during the 24 years between the Loma Prieta earthquake and when the new bridge was ready for use, did you have concerns about the old bridge that was still in use? Was there anything that you felt you needed to do to ensure safety in the interim?
We absolutely were concerned, and that was one of the things that drove a lot of the different approaches that we had to both the design and construction of the project. A lot of folks say, well, wait a minute, 20-plus years, were you really working as fast as you could? But the reality is, for a big structure like that, one of the first steps we had to do was to understand the existing structure, and that took a significant amount of analysis and research in and of itself. Once you then move over to the question of, okay, now that we understand the old structure and we see that we can't achieve what we want, this lifeline criteria, what do we have to do for a new bridge? There was a tremendous amount of geotechnical work that had to be performed, actually on-site drilling. We did more extensive geotechnical work on this project than we probably have ever done in the state of California for any project. All of that does take time. There were a lot of political discussions that take time for a project like this. That's just the nature of the beast. And actually, if you look back to the 1930s bridge, yes, they were able to get it built in roughly just a little bit under 4 years, but the political dialogue that ran up to that point was, depending upon which accounts you read, 10 to 15 years right there. So one thing we did do to at least try and buy back some degree of risk, we did do an interim retrofit on the existing East Span. We did what we could with what we had to at least try and assure it would perform better in the moderate type of seismic event that would be very likely within the period that we would be working on the new bridge. But really, that's about all you can do with that structure at this point in time.
Did you do anything to increase the intensity or frequency of inspections?
That bridge is on the standard federally required inspection schedule. It does have fracture critical members. One thing that did happen, the bridge actually did start showing its age while we were in the middle of construction. We did find an issue with one of the I-bar members on the old bridge. And as a result of that, we've now gone beyond. We've gone to a quarterly schedule in the I-bars as opposed to the standard two-year schedule that FHWA does have.
So that was the case, as I recall, where you actually used cables to double up the I-bar.
Well, we did a couple of different things. We had a short-term that was not a short-term fix that basically tried to relieve some of the stress on the I-bar, and that actually used some high-strength rods, not cables. But the more long-term fix was a more conventional, basically a bolted splice connection in the area of the I-bar head where the crack did develop.
Okay. So we're past that now. Can you tell us something about the design of the new East Span?
The design of the new East Span, a little bit of history on that. One of the things that we did do once we realized that a new span would be required, we did try and get the region involved in the decision-making process. I think we realized that if the state were simply to come in and say, we're building you a new bridge here and here's what it's going to look like, that would be a very challenging thing to do. People love their bridges. And I'm sure there are a lot of folks that love that old existing East Span. I think it's a beautiful bridge. But to put something of that significance in without getting input from the region probably would have been a huge political risk, and as such, we solicited the assistance of one of our regional partners, the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, which is the regional transportation planning agency for the Bay Area, and one of their offshoots is working with us now, the Bay Area Toll Authority, as you mentioned earlier. And we asked them to provide us for design recommendations. Basically, here's the general parameters that we are working with. These are the criteria that need to be achieved. With that said, what do you want it to look like? What are some of the functions that you would like to have it perform over and above what we have developed as basic criteria? And they very effectively put together a group, and within, at least a relatively short period of time, were able to pass back a recommendation to us, which was they wanted a cable-supported structure for the main span of the bridge. There is one navigable channel along the length of the East Span, and in particular, they ultimately decided that they wanted a self-anchored suspension span. That was an aesthetically driven decision. And that is what we now have out there for the main span. We've got about a 1.1 long viaduct section that approaches on the east side. Then you've got about a third of a mile long self-anchored suspension span, and then the transition structure over on Yerba Buena Island that takes it from a side-by-side configuration into a double-deck configuration to conform to the tunnel and the existing west span. And one of the other design considerations that was passed on to us by the region was they did want that side-by-side configuration on their new bridge. They didn't want a double-deck configuration. They wanted something open so that people could look around and have some views for the passengers. So that's how we got to the design that we do have. The self-anchored suspension span tends to get a lot of attention. It's the showpiece, certainly, of the structure. There is actually a tremendous amount of technical complexity in the entire bridge, and that, I think, is lost on a lot of folks. They'll look at the skyway portion, for example. That's the mile-plus long segment on the east side that runs up to the self-anchored suspension span, and they think it's a big, long concrete viaduct. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that, and is a pretty outstanding structure in and of itself. But obviously, visually, the self-anchored suspension span gets the lion's share of the attention. And it is, there are some unique aspects to it. Self-anchored suspension spans have been around for a long time, so there's nothing unique in that in and of itself. But what does make it unique is the fact that it is a single cable, and that single cable actually anchors into both the westbound and the eastbound decks at the east end of the span. So it actually wraps around the west end of the bridge. So you've got this single cable that runs up to the tower, back down, and has to do a 180-degree turn around the west end of the bridge, which is something cable doesn't like to do. So that was a pretty significant design and erection challenge in and of itself, and probably is one of the more unique things about that particular span.
So take us back a little bit. What's the difference between a self-anchored suspension bridge and an ordinary old suspension bridge that, for example, what you have in the west span?
it's pretty straightforward. On your conventional suspension bridge, you've got large anchorages that are built into the ground, typically into the rock. And your order of work is basically you build your foundations and your anchorages, and then you will hang your main cable, and then you will drop your suspender cables, and you will lift your deck segments up into place under the suspender cables. A self-anchored suspension span does not allow you to do that because the anchorage of the main cable is in the deck itself. You don't have these outboard ground-based anchorages to be able to do that. So your first order of work is to build the anchorage, which is the deck. And to be able to get the deck up and in place, you have to put temporary supports up, falsework, to support the deck. So you basically, you know, I think the simplest way we put it is you have to build a bridge to build a bridge. You have to have a very long, and in this case it was a long steel truss, temporary bridge set of falsework that supported the bridge deck. So the bridge deck segments were put up on top of the falsework, spliced together, tower was erected, and then the cable was run and anchored into the deck once it was in place. That is one of the reasons you don't see a lot of self-anchored suspension spans. They do tend to be a little bit more expensive because of that fact, the falsework component. And as you get into longer spans, obviously that cost goes up as well. But that's the fundamental difference between the two.
So if I understand the construction procedure, in a conventional suspension bridge, you build the anchorage, the cable, and you hang the deck from that. In the case of self-anchored bridge, you build the deck, and then the cable comes later.
Correct.
Now, you mentioned that you went to the community because people love their bridges and that this was an aesthetic choice on the community's part to have a self-anchored bridge. It also sounds like it's expensive and perhaps more time-consuming to build. Was that part of the discussion? Like, did you go back to the public and say, hey, you can have that bridge, but you know it's going to cost more and take longer?
Yes. Yes, that was part of the understanding. One thing that has certainly been a point of discussion as costs have gone up on that is, you know, aren't you just dumping a lot of money in aesthetics? And in some instances, if that buys you regional consensus, there is value in that. Because if you don't have consensus and you wind up with a big fight over what is this bridge going to look like, the amount of time that can be invested in that fight in and of itself will have a cost factor. So I think it's a little bit hard to hang the hat of cost, additional cost, solely on the aesthetic choice that was made here. And a lot of the cost, the fundamental cost involved in this structure really relates to its seismic criteria, that lifeline performance level that we were trying to achieve. There is a lot of cost involved in that. And if you look at the Skyway, for example, the cost of the Skyway was comparable to the cost of the main span. So there are a lot of working parts to why it cost as much as it did and why it took as long as it did. And again, aesthetics is a factor, absolutely. Was it the only factor? No.
And then you mentioned the lifeline nature of the bridge and the higher level of standard that was applied because of it being that. What are some of the earthquake-resistant features built into the new East Span?
Basically, the approach that was taken was, well, first of all, there's a tremendous amount of redundancy, and that's proven to be of huge value time and time again as we've gone through the construction process. It is, you know, the factor of safety that you use in design is extraordinarily well above what you would have on a typical structure. Some of the features that get a lot of attention are a lot of areas where the designers created what I think are most simply characterized as fusible links. They basically designed this in a fashion such that the introduced seismic forces are basically directed at particular areas that can take the damage. There are certain elements that are intended to deform and actually be taken beyond yield where they are going to be damaged and they are going to have to be replaced. But given their locations, that can be done while you're still maintaining traffic on the structure. There are some link beams that connect up the four tower elements, and the hinge connections are pipe beams that have intentionally deformed or reduced cross sections in the middle. Again, it's a pretty simple concept. They operate like fuses. We use battered piles, which for the Department of Transportation was something new, not something new in the industry by any means, but we borrowed from offshore oil technology in taking that kind of an approach to addressing seismic demands. So those are three things that people will tend to look at as some of the major focuses of attention in terms of seismic performance.
Close to the end of the construction period, there were a lot of news stories about bolt failures in the east span. Can you help us understand what the problem was and what the solution has been?
Certainly. At the eastern foundation of the main span, it's a marine foundation. At that location, we have several structural elements that are basically sandwiched between the deck of the bridge and the concrete cap beam of the foundation, the cap beam on top of the columns. We've got four shear keys and four bearings. The shear keys are there to basically limit the relative movement of the deck and the cap beam during a seismic event. Basically, it's trained to protect the bearings because the bearings obviously are intended to move and address live load. So those are all connected to both the deck and to the cap beam by a series of high-strength fasteners, in this case A354BD, that's the AS team standard. These are very large fasteners, and in the instance of the ones that we've had problems with, they range from 9 to 17 feet in length. These are 3-inch diameter high-strength rods. There are two locations among all of these eight elements where these rods actually sit directly over the concrete columns that are immediately below the cap beam. So they don't have great access. And this set of rods had to be pre-installed at an earlier date during construction and then raised into final position once all the structural elements were in place that allowed the shear keys to be fastened down. And roughly once these were tensioned up, and they are tensioned to a fairly high level, 0.7 of their ultimate tensile strength, once they were tensioned up within a fairly short period of time, roughly from 3 to, I think, 11 days, depending upon the rod involved, we started to see fractures in these rods. We had metallurgical analysis performed of fractured surfaces on some of these rods. The metallurgical team that looked at it determined that this was the result of internal hydrogen embrittlement. There was a little bit of uncertainty as to whether or not there was internal hydrogen resulting from the manufacturing process or if there perhaps was some environmentally introduced hydrogen given the length of time that they had been out there, and I'm not sure that's a question we'll ever be able to answer. But in any event, we had to come up with a modified approach to fastening down those shear keys at that location. And all of these rods had passed their primary mechanical tests per ASTM. One thing that we're doing in addition to finding an alternate means of fastening these shear keys down, we're looking at other areas where similar fasteners have been used just to make sure that we did not have a similar problem in any other area. But these two particular locations did have it was one particular batch, basically. And at this point in time, everything that we are seeing has been telling us there is some issue that relates to that particular batch, but we have a fairly strong metallurgical team that is out there now continuing to do some additional testing and analysis that will probably be ongoing over the next 6 months, I would guess, to try and assess where we're at with all the other fasteners. But one thing that we've heard loud and clear from both the metallurgists that we've had involved and all of the structural engineering and fracture mechanics specialists that we have involved in the project is what you're looking at now is, at most a long-term issue, not any kind of a short-term issue. And this may basically be a maintenance issue. So, or it may not be. We just don't know at this point in time, but it is something we're looking very, very carefully at.
But you're not worried about the safety of the bridge?
No, not worried about the safety of the structure. We're worried about the maintenance of the structure. Basically, this goes back to the fundamental issue of the design and the extraordinary factor of safety and the redundancy that we have in the design. So even at E2, for example, if we were to see other issues with any of the other rods, even on a long-term basis, you're not talking about a question of catastrophic failure. You're talking about a situation where damage would be sustained. But, we just don't want to see sustained on this structure because of its lifeline. Its lifeline strategy, its lifeline designation. But no, we're not. This is not something we're looking at from a safety perspective.
How did you detect this failure? Was it obvious? Was it a result of an inspection?
It was a result of an inspection, and you know, we've got a tremendous amount of effort focused on inspection. We've got folks out in the field. We have folks that are actually out of fabrication sites. We watch virtually every aspect of the making of the structure. In this case, a fracture of a rod of this type is fairly evident. You tension these down. The nut is flush with the surface that the fastener is connecting. And if you're out one day, you happen to notice that nut is elevated above where it's supposed to be, that's a pretty clear indication that you've got a fracture. And our inspectors out in the field noticed this almost immediately when it began occurring, because they're out there every single day, all day long.
So now the new section has been built to these higher levels of specs. How does the west span of the Bay Bridge, the iconic suspension bridge across San Francisco Bay, how does it now measure up in terms of its resilience to earthquake?
It also was retrofit to meet that lifeline designation. Now, in that particular instance, you've got a very robust structure founded on extraordinarily good geology. That whole thing is founded on rock. So the amount of work that had to be done to bring that bridge up to a lifeline standard was pretty straightforward and fairly small compared to the challenge that we had both over on the east side and over on the west approach of the structure. So that also does now meet lifeline criteria.
So now that the east span is in operation, it's a matter of, I suppose, tearing down the old one. What's that project going to look like?
You know, it's probably as complex bringing down the old structure as it is putting up the new structure. It has to be done very methodically, very carefully. All of this work is over water. It's over San Francisco Bay. It's, you know, there's boat traffic in the area. We've already had the opportunity to take down one fairly old truss structure. The old Carquinez Bridge was built in 1927. We'll be doing this bridge in a very similar fashion, basically piece by piece. So it'll be a fairly time-consuming process. We actually have a contractor on board right now to start the demolition work on the long cantilever span of the old east span, so people will actually start to see that coming down in the not-too-distant future.
Have you had any consideration of selling little bits and pieces of that demolition in order to fund the project?
No, but it actually, in effect, does. I mean, the salvage value of the steel is a factor in the contractor's bids for the work. So, you know, to that extent, yes, you do get some money back for that steel.
So you've had about 2 weeks of experience with users on the new east span. What's the reaction?
The reaction, at least that I've been seeing, has been overwhelmingly positive. From a traffic perspective, the only thing that we've seen that's been interesting to observe is traffic has actually been moving fairly slowly because people are looking at this new bridge, and in particular, they are looking at the main span. So we do have a little bit of congestion as people are approaching the main span of the structure. I'm sure that'll wear off over time. Other than that, the public reception has been extremely positive.
Well, I have a lot of experience going over the old span, and I'm looking forward to coming out there and enjoying the views from the new span, the single-level span. Spectacular project. I really appreciate your spending the time with us to tell us what you've been through and the details of this new bridge.
You know, I wonder, since the professor has so much experience crossing the old span, could you save a little chunk of it for him as a keepsake?
I'm sure we could come up with something.
That would really be a good thing. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.